You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.
Today on our show, I'm talking with Diego Lacari. Diego, thanks so much for talking with me today.
It's my pleasure to be here, Brainerd.
Diego, let's talk about what you're working on now. What's happening in your studio in Queens?
Well, it's a pretty dramatic situation here, which is that when I left school, my work had dematerialized somewhat and become very sort of, post-studio, sort of driven by ideas, conceptually oriented, and it stayed that way for all these years. It's been 11 years and some since I graduated. The financial burden of having a studio and stuff like that, it never really made sense considering that I felt like I could have a pretty, true practice just out of my kitchen or out of my desk and stuff like that. And so I sort of stayed that way for a while. But then recently, my wife and I have been fortunate enough to get a house, and we have sort of built out some spaces to be designated studio spaces. And so right now, really most of my time has been spent actually sort of like physically building out a studio space of my dreams, which is good.
That's in actually your house in Queens?
That's in our home. Yeah, it's in the basement. So she has the garage because she's a painter. Her name's Uni Che, and she needs the light and the space, and I need sort of seclusion and a feeling of isolation, and sort of I get a lot of creative freedom from thinking that no one is near me or behind me, and I start talking to myself and getting ideas out, and just things start bubbling when I feel alone. So I get the basement, and she gets the garage, and it's going to change things somewhat just because I feel like the most permanent surface I've really had to work on has been my desktop, and now I'm going to have sort of a lot of surfaces where I can actually let work sit, and I think a lot of the things that have sort of characterized my work, which I think are really crucial, have now sort of to be questioned whether they were just sort of confabulations of something that I sort of justified to myself because they were reflective of the condition of my whatever. I was working full time and I had, not that much free time, so I wasn't going to get a studio. I was just going to make things on my desk and things like that. And then eventually it turns itself around and it becomes, oh, Diego's doing this dematerialized work that's sort of like pushed into the corner, and it's sort of forced to be sort of conceptually driven and
right, because of, you mean, because of space constrictions, real estate, everything, that also is obviously a force working upon how you approach your practice.
Yeah, I'm a big believer that, there's a sort of material force that has shaped art historically, and, you had loft art when, certain real estate things allowed for people to move into Soho, and so you could fling lead across the studio, and then eventually, you come to this day where, I think a lot of small scale work, or at least process driven work that doesn't need to do a lot of stepping back, from what you're looking at. Like, I think that there is a certain kind of our physical spaces determine the kind of work that we make. But I think for me, a lot of it was somewhat optional. I mean, I could afford to get a studio when I was working full time. I think there was a sense of adventure. When I came to making art, I was I think I identified the painter as artist in my mind, and I pursued a particularly conformist idea of what an artist was, which is that I was going to make a series of paintings, it was going to have a particular distinct style, and then after 10 years I was going to change that style, and I was just going to ride it like some sort of Abex kind of genius or something. And so then through school I dismantled that, and I think I came out kind of really radically rebelling against that and wanting to have a practice that was so immaterial that I wouldn't even know what I was working on really unless I was forced to put it in a show, right? So that somebody could be like, what are you working on? The answer could be nothing, and it still wouldn't undermine the sort of the sort of intensity or honesty or power of my practice. So I went
of being potentially an Abex genius, right? I mean that track, in other words. could still be kind of that ideology almost could still be held, even if you're not making anything and you can't describe what you're working on, in other words, right?
Yeah, I think so. And I think some of it is like art school posturing or wanting to sort of test boundaries or having dad issues of being like, you know, don't, you know, like your dad buys you lunch and you're like, what's this about, dad? And it's like, you know, I just want to have some, like, lunch with you. There's nothing about here. I think there was a sense that as an artist, my job, especially as a, you know, identifying myself as a young artist, was to sort of say like, oh, there's these sort of like, you know, cultural expectations of what an artist is. And my job is to say like, let me see how I can rebel against them and stuff like that. So I think part of my desire to pursue sort of a dematerialized, conceptually driven practice had this sort of like idea of like the true artist is a groundbreaker sort of like built into it. And it did go well with the fact that I was kind of busy. I was running a space in Chicago. My time was constrained. I really didn't have the means to be, you know, spend 15 hours a day staring at a, you know, square or something. Like it just did, it didn't really fit.
Okay. So let me just put a few of these things in context.
Yes.
Graduated in 2007, MFA,
yes.
Art Institute of Chicago.
Yes.
We're talking about the time between then and now, which is 12 years. You've moved to New York. You've had full-time jobs. You bought a
yes.
house. It's a really big accomplishment in Queens.
Yes.
You had a variety of full-time jobs throughout this period?
No. Actually, the time in Chicago was a very full-time job intensive. The time in New York has been the opposite. It's been a real sort of like hodgepodge of jobs that don't have any sort of like future in them. I mean, I love being a studio assistant. I really enjoyed the artists that I worked with, but it wasn't going to lead to me eventually managing Chuck Close's studio. I think partly it's personal ambition. I think, you know, it's like I like working to the extent that it doesn't interfere with my other sort of ambitions as an artist. But anyway, no, it's the years that I've been in New York, which have been the last 5 years, 6 years, I've been working as a voting machine technician, and right now I teach after-school programs, and it's not been a profitable few years. It's been years where I've very much been dependent on my privilege and my, you know, family money and things like that. It's been a different mindset. The Chicago, I was really very much embodying a kind of like, you know, all the politicians go to the Midwest and tell them that they're the hardworking backbone of America. So when I was there, I was like, I'm also the hardworking backbone of America, and I worked very hard, and I ran a space on top of it, and I taught classes on top of a full-time job. So I was really being a very sort of like good Chicago artist. And I think in New York, I feel very guilty about like how I've managed to make it work, but I might actually be a very good New York artist, which is to say somebody that's finding loopholes and ways to sort of fit the practice that he or she wants or they want into an impossible city, you know, into an absolutely impossible city.
Well, as you said in the beginning, you're in a kind of, I mean, it's a really good point to talk a little more about the impossibility of New York as a city, as thriving as an artist, especially with that really kind of, I think it's an astute observation, and I agree with that. You know, the practice of loft spaces and doing these giant paintings that are like 15 feet long, you know, were a function of that kind of space. That wasn't incredibly possible in New York then. That was, you know, working two or three nights a week as a bartender funded your 5,000 square foot loft for the month.
That's right.
You know, it was
That's
kind
right.
of a whole different story. So now, as you said, you're in the kind of post-studio world, post-studio practice mentality. You're out of Chicago. You're in New York where space is even tighter. You know, it's like basement or garage. There's not like you're in a big studio somewhere.
Yeah. I mean, I'm an exception now, but yes. Now
so
I'm
so you said your practice
space.
Initially was
yeah.
kind of really pushing back, really kind of a
yeah.
kind of radical of pushing back of all of that. So you've come, not full circle, but so where are you now? You're still in the kind of, you have a studio. You have a physical studio.
Yeah,
you can make stuff in there.
Yeah, it's interesting. It's a question that I don't know. You know, there's a chance. I mean, there's a possibility that I'm really just a repressed painter in some ways, and like painting is my lost love, and I had to reject it because I was angry at it, and it didn't love me back enough. I mean, painting is a very complicated medium. I think like I have a fantasy of art as sort of like breaking through, and I think painting, to a certain degree, you have to accept the limitations of, you know, it's like certainly there's groundbreaking artists, like painters, don't get me wrong, but I think like a good painter understands that a painting is a painting, you know, and sort of like can deal with the fact that like, unless you're getting to Picasso and you're really trying to break through this thing, you're trying to crack it, I think like the good painters are sort of comfortable with the fact that like a painting is not going to surpass its sort of like humbleness and its sort of material messiness, and you know, there's a certain amount of control that you can exercise over it and stuff like that. And so I think like I was very angry at painting and painting the signifier of painting and stuff like that, and I've rejected it. And I think like, who knows, like maybe now if I have a space, like I'll actually have worked something through in a way, either psychologically that I actually worked it through, or actually I never had anything to work through. It was just that I didn't have a space, and I have a space again, and I can feel comfortable about it. I don't have guilt about the waste of having a space because it's sort of factored into my cost of living at this point. And I'll go back to being a painter in a way that I think is so antithetical to my practice right now. Literally is like, my wife is a painter, loves painting, completely devoted to painting, and I'm everything else, right? It's like I just don't touch painting like at all, like in my practice. Like it's like and so it seems like almost like an avoidance, like some sort of like a psychological avoidance, like I'm purposely avoiding painting. And maybe it's my, you know, it's my neglected love. Like I'll just realize like it's okay, like I can accept now that I'm 40 that I'm not gonna change the world. I'm just going to make a really good painting. Now, I say that, Brainerd, not because I believe that. I don't feel myself as a frustrated painter, but I'm open to this possibility that having a studio is going to really reorient things in a way that reemphasizes how much of my thinking over the last few years may have been contingent on like real life things and not the other way around, that they weren't driven by some idea of like what I think art should be. And to me, that in itself is a really important value, because as an artist, I really do want to emphasize that like our lives are an element as a maker. Like the fact that I want to be loved and want to be rewarded, like that's totally part of like what I want as an artist, right? That's not like distinguishable, right? Like the fact that I would be comfortable in a space where everybody's saying like, good job, this is interesting, tell me about it. Like that's a factor that has driven me to be an artist and driven artists to be artists. And we can't sort of like, you know, erase all that, you know, and erase like the sort of,
yeah, you know, that's really interesting, because there's all these things of life that comes in. I interview a lot of people, and a lot of my take is, you know, these people who seem like they're just focusing on their work. Well, you know, they have a job teaching, and their job teaching or whatever they're doing affords them a certain kind of freedom. They seem to have a kind of, calmness about what they're doing, and they pursue their quote-unquote practice calmly and with a kind of steadfast kind of quality that's admirable. But also there's a lot of nuances to that I'm not seeing that you're mentioning now. So maybe you do have, like someone has, which is kind of like the opposite of perhaps your situation, but it includes, as I understand it, what you're saying now, perhaps someone has a job teaching, and it's a steady job, and they're a tenured professor, and they're also, they have a decent studio in town. But then there's a million other factors are happening. You know, they just got divorced for the second time. Their kid has a, you know, special needs or something, or they have their own, bodily needs of difficulty. They were just diagnosed diabetic or whatever it is, you know, that all of those things affect our practice. And it seems to me, in talking to you now, that a lot of artists that I talk to, and perhaps it's also the way I conduct interviews, but, you know, art practice is separated as though it's this formal exercise that doesn't, you know, that isn't affected by like every subtlety in our day, like whether we're having a good day or a bad day, whether we felt rejected or embraced or loved or not loved. But as I understand what you're saying, and it's making me rethink kind of how I'm approaching a lot of these interviews, all of that, of course, affects every bit of what you're doing as an artist.
I mean, it's like, you know, I think people are afraid. There's definitely a practice, I think, that we learn in like English lit class or something, where we psychoanalyze an author. And I think a lot of us don't love that, right? I don't think a lot of us think like, oh, that's enjoyable, because to some degree, that's very simplifying. I mean, you're doing it in English class, so it's probably not the most deep sort of analysis, et cetera. But I think we also have a fear of demystifying, right? That if we say like, oh, you know, Sarah had a big studio and led, and so it occurred to him to fling it around. But if he had a small studio, he wouldn't have flung it around because it would have gotten in his face or something like that. But that somehow takes away the magic of the thing. And I'm really not, you know, it's like, or maybe I'm projecting that people do that and thinking myself special for not doing it. But I really think, like, you know, it's like the more you know about science and like the world, like the more magical the world is, not the less magical the world is. And I definitely don't want to, I make a lot of work that includes me and includes my life and includes the effect that the work is going to have on my life in it. But I'm not necessarily that interested in being like so autobiographical and like revealing. And I mean, who knows, maybe someday, you know, aspects of my parenting or my marriage are going to come into my work, but I don't really feel like I have to like pour out and want to be like analyzed. I just want to sort of be understood that these are not an invisible things. These are things that factor in. Like, we have to count them. When we look at art, like, we have to count the body of the artist, and we have to count the sort of, like, the life of the artist as elements. They don't have to force anything out or erase any magic, but they certainly are part of how we read a work. I mean, they, you know, how we understand how people live is part of how we understand how an artist maybe is an exception from that or isn't an exception from that, you know? And it informs our understanding of what we're looking at. So I think, like, I mean, you know, my work doesn't, I don't know that it has a specific focus, but the last few years have been very much about, like, you know, like how, like what Diego wants, kind of, you know, like, does Diego want to grow and is art the place where he grows as a human being? Does Diego want friends and like art is a place where he can like be with people that he like enjoys, and by being together, it can make something special that isn't just the kind of like crass instrumentalization of socializing or anything like that. It's actually something sort of special. And these are questions I don't know the answer to. It could be that art touches things and makes them all shit, you know, because of the context, because it's associated with, you know, things that we don't like. And as much as we value art and its sort of pure state, like, we have to accept that it's been operating in a world that is really kind of like, you know, like inappropriate, we don't like it, banana, and therefore we can't do anything called art that doesn't. I'm thinking of like social practice, for example. I'm thinking of things that like are really good, and then the question is like, does calling it art somehow actually like hurt it in some way, because it brings it into this other world of concentration of cultural value and sort of like, you know, historicization and things like that, that like aren't at all about like the immediate contact of being with people and generating something of value in a community, right? Like, those things are sort of like opposed. Right. Anyway, Brainerd, I'm a talker, just so you know. I can.
Okay, no, that's fine. So let me ask you one more question though, about all this, because this is really interesting. So that's what your last year has been about, and now you have this studio on your website, which is primarily where I got to see some of your work. There's a lot of drawings and cartoons. It's a very long page.
Yes.
I'd like to talk about some of that work, or just mention some of that's happening right now, because you exist in a way visually right now for me, you know, because I haven't seen your shows, through your website and what's happening there. So what about that last visual work? Is that something we should talk about? We could just mention the last show you've had, or we can talk about what's on your website.
We can talk about what's on my website. So the website for me has just always been a problematic vehicle for dissemination of work. People are like, oh, I've seen your work, I really like it. And it's like, no, you've seen my website. So I've always wanted to have something on my website, which was a work that exists independently. It's not documentation. It's not something else. And then deeper in the website, as a kind of Easter egg, I have the actual documentation, and you can see a lot of the images of work. But the work that's in there now currently is this comic that I've written, and I'm still in the process of finishing it. This last year, because of this studio thing, homeownership stuff, it's really taken a break. But I'm going to get back to it. It's this comic strip about these two ducks that maybe represent sort of like two sides of me, or two sides of a conversation that I either imagine is out there, project is out there, or is generally out there about ways of living. I mean, I think Game of Thrones is kind of a question about like, what are the principles that should sort of guide us? I think there's something, there are cultural questions that we're asking ourselves about. Even the first season of True Detective, you know, do we sort of like do things by the book, follow the rule, or do we sort of like read between the lines and stuff? Like, I like that we're in a moment now where we're having conversations about like genuine, really healthy postmodern conversations about like what are the values that are going to be driving our culture and our way of living. And so these two ducks are just sort of like one is a duck in a lake and the other is a duck in a zoo. And the duck in a lake is kind of like a little paleo. He's kind of like, you know, I get to live the real life because I'm sort of like, you know, eating from the earth, and I get to have these genuine experiences of nature, and I get to sort of like, you know, just interact with animals as we were meant to interact, as our sort of like, you know, the evolutionary development got us to put in. And the duck in a zoo is kind of like, hey man, like modernity has come, and like there's a better way to be a duck, which is like I'm being fed and I'm being taken care of, and they, you know, they take my sperm every once in a while to propagate my species and to preserve my genetic diversity, and I get free Wi-Fi and all this stuff. And so they're having a kind of endless conversation where one is kind of being like a radical and being like, no man, you got to fight for your independence and your truth and like, you know, like all these sort of like enlightenment values pretty much. And the other one is saying like, hey, and, you know, enlightenment's all right, but, you know, there's some practical benefits to sort of like dismantling all that old stuff. And neither of them are right. I mean, in the end, I think they're both sort of held to a structuralist program. And there's a salamander that emerges as a way to sort of disrupt that. But it's a way, I think, to exercise some of my sort of like confusions and feelings and stuff like that. It's gotten a little dated. There's a joke in there that's clearly written before the Me Too movement. So it's a project that needs to wrap up soon, but I'm in the process always of tweaking jokes. And right now
the conversation, the project in wrapping up, and the reason it's such a long page on your homepage of your website is because it wasn't done in a day or a week. It keeps getting added on to. These are characters that keep talking. It's a conversation that keeps going.
It is. It has an end, though. I mean, it's not meant to be. It's meant to feel endless. It's meant to be a little like My Dinner with Andre. Like, what I wanted it to be was to be a feature-length comic, right? So right now it reads at a reasonable speed at about an hour, and I want to put another 15 minutes in. And I know that I want it, spoiler alert, I want it to end with both ducks realizing the limitations of their insistence. They both think they're free, but it's positioned against somebody else's idea. And so they need to both understand the contingency of their ideas of freedom and develop maybe something new. But I think the comic should end with them both kind of being like, we're both prisoners, right? The duck that is free is a prisoner. The duck that is in a zoo is a prisoner. Like, they're both trapped. While I want the reader to feel as they're scrolling through my website, like there's no end, like there's no way to get out. They can't go left. They can't go right. They just can keep deeper and deeper into this conversation. I do want in the end there to be a punchline. I mean, I hope there's many punchlines, but I want there in the end to be a punchline where the work is done. It's not meant to be to be continued forever. And then when it's done, I'll leave it up on the website for another maybe 6 months or so. And then hopefully I'll come up with a new work that I'll put on the website as the sort of the work that people see when they see my website. And then if they want to see the other things that I've done, exhibitions, then they have to sort of dig through. In the current website, it's at the end of the duck story. You have to click on my name, and then you can get to see all my shows and all that stuff. But it's the biggest work I've ever done, Brainerd. I've never done anything. My work has been really very quick, very sort of like I have an idea. It resonates in a certain way. I commit to doing it. I do it maybe 85 to 87% of how well it needs to be done to succeed. I set it out there and see if it's doing what it needs to do. And I've had a pretty good track record for the most part, but, you know, that's maybe for other people to determine. This work was really like, you know, like a year of adding, you know, ducks every 3 days or so. And now it's taken a break. But I just need to put in another like month or two, and I think I can just like I can wrap it up. And it's not like I want to be done with it, but I do kind of, never having done a project this big, like I've never written a novel or anything like that. I've never really done a feature length film. I do want to reap the satisfaction of being like, ah, they both look at each other, they say, ah, we're fucked, and then that's it, you know?
Right. Well, great. I'm glad we talked about that. Let me ask you one more question.
Yes.
What are you reading at the moment? I'm always curious what people are reading.
Well, I don't want to undo like everything I've said, but I'm not the most avid reader. I don't think I'm dyslexic or anything like that. I enjoy reading magazines and stuff like that. I think the most interesting book that I've read in the last however long, though, and I didn't really finish it, was this book by this Kurdish, I forget which faction of Kurdish liberation he's in. His name is Abdullah Öcalan, and he wrote this book about the roots of Western civilization. I think that's the name, the roots of Western civilization. It's his prison writings, some of his prison writings. And he's just doing like the history of the world, and it's amazing. I mean, it's just like, it puts a very interesting perspective on some of the very foundational. As a Kurd, he speaks from a position of kind of like, We are the root of civilization. Like, we come from, like, its place, like, of birth. And so he seems to speak with a kind of, like, a certain kind of authority, as if, like, and he's really telling the story of this germinal moment of the consolidation of state power and of the displacement of the female priestess. And it's fascinating, but I can't really go into that great detail because, as a lot of things I read, I get really excited about it, but then I don't have a good habit of reading. I have a very bad reading practice. So I read on buses, and I read on airports, and I read in certain key places, but I have a hard time reading at home. But I would recommend the book regardless.
Diego, thanks so much for talking to me today. I really appreciate your time and your work.
Brainerd, thank you so much for hearing me out. I really appreciate you having the curiosity.
You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.